Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Doug Jones, the Democrat in the Alabama Senate race, has a new ad out today featuring Republicans against his opponent, Roy Moore.
I'm a lifelong Republican, but I just can't do it.
I can't vote for Roy Moore.
He's already been removed from office twice.
This time it's even worse.
Also today, Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan joined those calling on Moore to get out of that race. Yesterday, a fifth woman came forward to accuse Moore, saying he assaulted her in a locked car when she was 16. He said he'd never met her, but she produced a yearbook which was signed with "Love, Roy Moore." Andrew Yeager of WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama, is here. And Andrew, Moore has fierce supporters, but we're also hearing stories today about how the then 30-something district attorney, Roy Moore, would go to local malls to meet teen girls?
Yeah, we're starting to see people talk to the media remembering that time from the late 70s, early 80s, saying that Roy Moore was a known figure and known to kind of flirt with or go after young girls. This was something that wasn't hidden, at least as they describe it. And this is something that they say we're kind of surprised didn't come out sooner.
Yeah, well, you have people like a former colleague, Teresa Jones, telling CBS, it was common knowledge that Roy dated high school girls. We wondered why someone his age would hang out at high school football games in the mall. The Washington Post and The New Yorker have both reported this. But it seems as if Moore is vigorously denying this, and his supporters seem to still be backing him.
His supporters are still backing him. His campaign manager was making the rounds this morning on Alabama media, and he's not giving any ground. He's saying these are false. And in terms of this fifth accuser, I've never met her. I've never been to the restaurant that is involved in these claims. And so, yeah, he's saying the same thing he's always said since this story broke last week.
Well, what's the sense of what happens now?
You know, Roy Moore is such a polarizing figure, so a lot of how you look at this depends on what you think of Roy Moore. If you like Roy Moore, chances are you're on the side of this is fake news, this is an unfair attack, this is false. He has such a core group of supporters that are with him through thick and thin, and there's really nothing electorally. Well, he's on the ballot regardless, and it appears that this election is going to go ahead in less than a month. So we just kind of continue in the same pattern, so it seems.
His competitor in the primary, Luther Strange, who President Trump backed, has said it's highly unlikely he'll do a write-in campaign against Moore in December. The Washington Post has floated the idea that maybe now Attorney General Jeff Sessions, whose seat Moore is competing for, could even return to that seat. How so?
Well, it would be through a write-in campaign, presumably. And there aren't really a lot of options for Republicans. Our current governor, Kay Ivey, has said that she's not going to move the date of the election. Our Secretary of State here in Alabama does say if Moore, for whatever reason, would step aside, you know, the election would go ahead. If he won, it would be declared invalid, and then we would be back to having a special election once again.
Well, that brings us to the Democrat, Doug Jones. So it's not a given that if Moore steps out of the race that Doug Jones automatically wins. The election's declared invalid if Moore wins.
Correct.
But Doug Jones' tactic right now, putting forth Republicans who say they're not going to vote for Roy Moore, how risky is that?
I don't know how risky it is, but I think that if Doug Jones wants to win, he has to do that. This is a very conservative state. Donald Trump did well here. Republicans do well here. They hold all levels of state government. And so he has to get moderate Republicans if he has any chance to win. He has to convince those folks to actually go to the ballot box in a busy holiday season and cast a vote for him and not just stay at home because they don't like how this Roy Moore story has you know, kind of gone along.
Is there something interesting here in the fact that many of Roy Moore's supporters are evangelicals? And we see those that are sticking with him, you know, evangelicals supporting someone who, you know, has several allegations of abuse against him, sexual abuse.
Yeah, it certainly is something to parse and look at. What I think is interesting about the evangelical vote is that you see a split, and you saw this back in 2016 with President Trump, too, is you have a split between older evangelicals and younger evangelicals. I was talking with a few people last week who were, you know, younger evangelical types who were not favorable to Moore, and this was something that made them even less favorable to Moore. You know, it's not uniform, as all groups are. But yeah, it is I think it's particularly troubling within religious communities and for a figure like Roy Moore, who has tied himself so closely to religious proclamations and making a stand on religious grounds.
That's Andrew Yeager of WBHM in Alabama. Andrew, thanks so much.
Happy to be with you, Robin.
Well, President Trump returns to the United States today, ending his 12-day tour of Asia. He spoke to reporters this morning aboard Air Force One.
I think one of the things we really accomplished big is relationship, and also letting people know that from now on, things are going to be reciprocal. We can't have trade deficits of 30, 40, 50 billion, 300 billion in the case of China. We can't do that. We have to have reciprocal trade. What's good for them is good for us.
Trade was just one of the items on the trip's agenda, which also included tough talk on North Korea's nuclear program. Richard Haass is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the book A World in Disarray. He joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
And the White House is touting this trip as a victory for U.S. companies and for international trade. What's your assessment of Trump's trip to Asia?
Well, it's odd they would single that out because that's arguably the weakest part of the trip. The fact that the United States stayed outside of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the principal regional trading mechanism right now, will hurt American exporters, whether they're agricultural exporters, manufacturing, whether in the financial services businesses. We won't have the kind of market access we need. It'll weaken our ability to set standards and rules throughout the region that would be in our interest. And these individual deals that are going to be announced won't begin to offset that loss.
And many of the other countries that were a part of the TPP deal are going ahead with it. They're going to be in that deal.
Absolutely. They are going to go ahead with it. And China won't be in it. China's going to go ahead with its own trading scheme. But the fact that the United States is not going to be a part of the TPP essentially reduces its size by half. So, again, it weakens what something that we helped negotiate, but we're now not going to be a part of it.
One of the storylines that has come out of this trip is that world leaders have learned how to play President Trump, that all you have to do is flatter him, give him a big military parade to welcome him to the country, and he'll do what you want. Is that your assessment?
I think a little bit of that seems to be true. You had the first such episode when he went to Saudi Arabia, the first foreign trip of his presidency. You had a version of it here in China with the time spent in the Forbidden City in Beijing. And the president is prone to that. It's not simply his talk about the red carpet, but he keeps talking about personal relationships. Now, he's not the first president to exaggerate the significance of relationships. FDR did it with Stalin, and virtually every president since has done it to some extent. But this president has raised it to a new level, and I think he overlooks the fact that other leaders may see a good relationship as a tactic towards the strategic end of advancing what they see as their own interests.
Well, on that score, what did you make of President Trump saying that President Putin told him he didn't meddle in our election and he believes him?
Well, that was one of the low points of the trip. It was a major distraction. The fact that he was so critical of former intelligence officials on foreign soil only added to it. Look, it wasn't a departure. This president has been strangely benign towards Russia from the get-go, and I think it's a mistake because Russia needs to be called out and pay a price anytime it violates the norms of international relations as we see them, whether it's their conquest of Crimea, whether it's their indiscriminate use of force in Syria, or whether it's meddling in our elections.
Another pattern that we noticed on this trip is that sometimes President Trump would meet with the leader of another country and then they would come out and say, the president did raise this issue with, for example, President Duterte of the Philippines. He did bring up human rights. And then the president of the Philippines comes out with a statement and says it was never raised. What do you make of that?
Just that if it was raised, it seems to have been simply to go through the motions. But the fact that the president, first of all, had a bilateral meeting with this someone who's been so associated with thousands of non-judicial murders in a place like the Philippines, I would have suggested if he has to go to the country for a regional meeting, he doesn't do a bilateral meeting. But then to do one and make no public criticism of what's going on there it seems to me wrong for the long term in U.S.-Philippine relations, because we associate ourselves so much with a leader who I predict will one day be extraordinarily unpopular in that country. But also, the United States foreign policy has to some extent also reflect our values. It has to reflect our DNA. And I think the president does himself and does this country no favor when he ignores the fact that we do stand for some things, or at least we're meant to.
Do you think the president made any progress on the situation in North Korea on this trip?
That's the most interesting question, quite possibly, and I don't think we know the answer. It obviously was discussed in his first three stops, in particular in Tokyo and Seoul in Beijing. The president's talk about the North Korean issue was more moderated, was more modulated, seemed to be more open to a diplomatic outcome. So I'm hoping that was the case, and we'll get a sense over time whether North Korea is at all interested in going down that path. I hope so, because the alternatives of either living with an ever larger North Korean nuclear and missile arsenal or going to war against North Korea, those alternatives are so unattractive that I hope there'll be some return on the diplomatic investment of this trip.
That's Richard Haass, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Imagine if you found out that your childhood home in New York State was part of the Underground Railroad, that the town you lived in was the only town north of the Mason-Dixon line to have seceded from the Union, and that the woman who lived in your house, Mary Willis, helped slaves get to Canada. That's what author Darren Wong discovered about his past, and it's the basis for his new novel. Here he is reading from The Hidden Light of Northern Fires.
With each fugitive she carried downtown, Mary felt as if she were sending something of herself into the world. She understood that there were dozens of others like her in the chain of barns and chicken shacks where each fugitive had sheltered, and in that she felt some kinship, some belonging. She wished there was some way she could send word back to each hand that had helped and let them know that they had been delivered, that their risks had not been in vain. But she could not, of course. She could know the previous stop and the next, but nothing more.
Darren Wong joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
And the inspiration for this novel came from your childhood home in Town Line, New York. You say it was the only town north of the Mason-Dixon line to secede from the Union during the Civil War.
Yes, it seceded in December of 1861, about 7 months after the war had started, and didn't rejoin until 1946, believe it or not.
And how did you learn that history?
We had always had heard stories about the secession. The Town Line Fire Department, their shoulder patch says "Last of the Rebels, 1865 to 1946" on it. So it's kind of the little town, the little hamlet's identity, really.
And the house that you grew up in was actually part of the Underground Railroad.
Yeah. So and that part was a little bit more hidden, I think, would be the term, because we'd had rumors about it being an Underground Railroad station, but we also heard ghost stories about the front house as well. And it all, you know, if you're growing up, you're 5 or 6 years old, 10 years old, it all kind of melds together. And I left that place when I was a fairly young child. It was only years later that I found an oral history of the Willis family, the family that had built the house, that kind of detailed the Underground Railroad activity and the rest of the family's involvement in the Civil War.
And all of that is the inspiration for your main character, Mary Willis. How did you find out about her?
So in this oral history, it talks a little bit about her, and then I just went on this crazy three-year-long process of research, because, you know, growing up in Town Line, I always felt like it was the middle of nowhere. But suddenly I found out that there was this deep, rich history of the place I had grown up. And I interviewed a bunch of her descendants. I did a lot of research in legal records around town and down in the Erie County, New York courthouse, into all kinds of house museums and everything all around the area. So I kind of dug in every kind of corner I could find.
And what did you learn about Mary Willis?
She graduated from Alfred University, which was only the second school in the country to accept women on a co-ed basis. And she came home and started running this Underground Railroad station in 1858, 1859. And that's such a radical thing for a young woman to do. I have a list of confirmed Underground Railroad operators in Western New York, and it's couples or it's gentlemen, and then there's one single woman on the list. So the idea of her as kind of this radical feminist abolitionist kind of came together, because that's what her biography says. It's a radical thing for a woman to go to college in 1858.
So how much of her character in your novel is based on reality, and how much of it did you have to imagine?
You know, of course, you have to imagine somebody's thoughts and their mindset and their motives and what they cared about. But I felt a real kinship for her. I grew up in her house. I'd get up in the morning and see the same thing she would. So it's a combination of that sensibility, I think, you know, of knowing a landscaping, knowing a place, and kind of, I think, knowing her sense of isolation. Town Line was not a place that would have been welcoming to a woman of her politics.
Was it difficult, though, for you as a 21st century man to imagine what life was like for her?
Yeah, I mean, certainly. But I'm half Chinese, right? And I grew up in this very, it's a kind of place that would secede from the Union. It's not friendly to minorities. It certainly wasn't at the time when I was there. And I understood her isolation, I think, and that helped me drive her character forward. I think helped me understand who she was. But it also, I consider myself something of an idealist, and I think that she was as well. She was very political. In her records, I find, for example, her children, her first son's middle name was Lincoln, her second son's middle name was Sherman. You pretty much have a good sense of where her politics lay.
It's one thing to imagine the life of Mary Willis. It's another, and I was wondering this as I was reading this, to imagine what it's like to be a brutal slave owner. Was that difficult to put yourself into that mindset, to write about what they were thinking, what they were saying?
You know what's interesting, I think, about that character. So Yates Bell, who has an interesting historical basis, his hatred of African Americans or slaves at that point is driven by more than just race. I think that's oftentimes the case, that there's race, but there's anger about this and that. That felt very real to me. I knew parts of me that I could plumb and explore and reapply. You know, I think it's easy for us to remember things that we've been angry about, politics or slights or whatever, and just kind of transpose those into characters to help bring them alive on the page.
Why do you think that this story resonates today? I couldn't help but thinking that we've had a lot of civil war in the news recently.
Well, we're in essence, we're still fighting the Civil War. The battle's ended. The generals stopped issuing commands, but there's still shots being fired on it on a daily basis, I think. The Civil War was never properly finished. When Lincoln was shot and his ideas of Reconstruction and reconciliation fell by the wayside, those issues never were taken up. You think of like how South Africa dealt with essentially the same kind of issues and how things have leapt forward for that country. It's far from perfect, but the ideas about reconciliation have never been resolved in this country. And certainly our politics today have driven this back to the surface again.
I noticed that as you've been promoting your book, you're spending most of the time in the South, even though this is a story about a northern town. What does that tell you? Or is the Civil War only something that people want to hear about in the South?
Certainly the memory of the Civil War is much more alive in the South than in the North. It's interesting to me how the North kind of ignores all of these stories unless it comes up in the context of current news, whereas the Civil War is present on every street corner in the South. I think it also extends to a greater sense of history, too, in the South. The South is obsessed with history in ways that the North is not.
I want to ask you one more question, Darren Wong, and that is that in addition to being the author of this book, you are also the founding executive director of the Decatur Book Festival in Decatur, Georgia. First of all, why do you think it's so important to have a book festival in Decatur, Georgia? And secondly, what have you noticed about readers right now with all the other entertainment options that are out there? Are you seeing big crowds come to the book festival, or are people just watching TV and, you know, using their devices?
Well, Decatur, Georgia is about 5 miles, 6 miles east of downtown Atlanta. So Decatur, Georgia deserves a big book festival because it's one of the cultural centers of Atlanta, Georgia. And our attendance this year at the festival is higher than it has ever been. You know, we get great big crowds. I mean, we had about somewhere between 75,000, 85,000 people come out to the festival this year. And I think with everything that's going on, people enjoy the sense of disconnecting from technology for a couple hours to sit down with a book in a well-lit space. There's nothing better than that. And so the actual physical act of reading is a pleasure for a lot of people when there's so much going on. And also, I think the idea of a long, thoughtful piece of fiction or nonfiction is a real tonic to, you know, the constant input that we're getting in our days these days. There's a sense of peace that comes with it that I think people are looking for more and more.
That's Darren Wong, whose new novel is called The Hidden Light of Northern Fires. Darren, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And staying in Georgia for a minute, there's a debate over leggings. Two fifth grade girls asked the Atlanta School Board last night to change its student dress code, which bans clothing that is extremely tight and distracting. The girls don't like that word, distracting. According to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, 10-year-old Phelan Handley told the school board, distracting is a label only applied to girls' clothing. I do not believe that clothing is a distraction, she said. It's just the reaction that matters. I should not be punished for other people's behavior. I am not a distraction. The school board will consider the change later this month and should have a final decision on leggings by January.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Bob Gamcourt, the CEO of the coffee company Keurig, has apologized to his employees for using Twitter to communicate the decision to pause, as he put it, advertising on Sean Hannity's show. Keurig, Realtor.com, and Volvo all pulled ads after Hannity seemed to support Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore, both on his Fox News TV show and on his radio show, after Moore was accused of sexual harassment and assault. But Hannity fans took their anger out on Keurig, maybe because they couldn't throw their Volvos off the roof as they did their Keurig coffee machines. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, also co-host of Velshi and Rule. Ali, so there you are at MSNBC, big Fox competitor, but we want you look at this from a business perspective.
Yeah.
Keurig seems to be apologizing for using, you know, Twitter to announce this. Gamcourt said that gave the appearance of taking sides. But I don't think they're apologizing for pulling their ads because of Hannity's content. How do you do with handling this?
This is trying very hard to walk a fine line, and I don't think it's all that successful. Mm. I mean, the bottom line is Keurig did make a decision not to advertise. And one of the problems that companies have when they take a decision to pull advertising from an event or a TV show is that there are two steps to that. One is we're pulling the ad and we're not financially supporting you. And then the other one is how you handle that with the public. With some companies, it pays them to make a fairly big statement about the fact that we're doing it. Other companies would prefer to do it a little more quietly. And I think Keurig was trying to say Twitter wasn't the right place to do it. Nobody really believes that's the issue. Yeah. The fact is Keurig did it. Then there were pictures posted on social media about people taking Keurig machines that had already been bought, and you know, destroying them and throwing them out. So it's I'm not sure this sort of apology kind of thing is meaningful.
Well, because you know, Keurig might have consumers who are applauding them pulling the ads, but now they're feeling like they're abandoned there. And we should say it was the left-leaning Media Matters that pushed these companies to pull their ads. But now we have a coffee war because you have Donald Trump Jr., Hannity fans, and Sean Hannity himself promoting Black Rifle Coffee Company. This is owned by a veteran. They call themselves the Premium Conservative Coffee Company. We're a polarized country, Ali.
Yeah, I mean, you would have thought that generally speaking, coffee, and some of the other companies, by the way, that pulled out, Cadillac, AARP, a lot of them, they're conservatives and liberals who use these services and buy these products. But when you pull out of, when one coffee company pulls out, your only choices then are to try and promote the conservative coffee company. So yeah, there is a thing called Black Rifle Coffee. It is pro-gun rights, pro-military, pro-Donald Trump. And it has sort of made the point that it is going to be, it wants to be the coffee for conservatives. It's got some funny names for some of its coffee. This becomes kind of tricky. I mean, as a coffee drinker, I don't know how much I'd move because of the politics of the coffee company. But Starbucks has faced this in the past. Other companies have faced this where they take a, you know, Starbucks took a position on not having people with guns come into their stores. And there was an attempt to boycott Starbucks. As you can see, Starbucks is doing just fine.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, where do you see this heading? But it sounds as if, although it just seems kind of sad that we are so divided over so many things and now maybe even products. But we'll follow this. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor, economics correspondent, also co-host of Velshi and Rule, taking a look at, we'll post some of the videos of people destroying their Keurig coffee makers. On the other hand, some people are saying, I'm getting everyone Keurig coffee makers for Christmas. So we'll see how this plays out. Ali, thank you.
My pleasure.
We've reported here on the homeless crisis on the West Coast, from Seattle to the San Francisco Bay Area down to San Diego. A lot of it driven by the high-tech boom that's exploding rents. Well, it's getting worse. Over the past 2 years, at least 10 cities or regions in Washington State, Oregon, and California have declared states of emergency because of homelessness, not natural disasters. This is a first. There are now 168,000 homeless people in those three states, up 19,000 from 2 years ago. A Seattle city councilman says his city has pretty much zero unemployment, but thousands of working homeless people. San Diego scrubs its sidewalks with bleach to counter a hepatitis A outbreak. In Los Angeles, young people 18 to 24 are the fastest growing homeless group by age. One of the reasons, between housing and tuition, they're choosing tuition. All of this is reported in a new series investigation from the AP that will continue through the end of the year. AP reporter Gillian Flackus is based in Portland, Oregon. She joins us. Hi, Gillian.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, but I tell you, it's shocking what you and your colleagues saw. Tell us, for instance, about the couple in their 60s. They've been living with a friend, and what happened?
Both of them are on disability, and those payments were enough combined for them to rent a room in a friend's house in Seattle for a number of years. But then that friend died of cancer, and the house was sold, and they were out on the streets. And they found that with those combined payments, they could no longer afford to rent a room or an apartment. And so they used the last of their savings to buy a used RV. And they bought a car at a junkyard for $275 as well. And now they are living in that RV on a side street in Seattle near a little municipal airport. It's just really a bad situation for them.
Oh, listen, you went and visited them. They go to the bathroom in a bucket.
Yes, and that's not unusual. Anywhere between 30 and 40% of the homeless population in Seattle is living in a car or an RV like they are. They don't have sewer hookups or water hookups, so they have to make do with going to the bathroom in a bucket, dumping it kind of surreptitiously out behind businesses, showering at nonprofit organizations. This particular couple didn't have propane for their stove or their kitchen in the RV, so they were just kind of making do with what they had, eating cold foods, bars, things like that.
Well, look, and this is a couple, you know, with disabilities. They make about $17,000 a year, can't find any housing. But you and your team also met people like Ellen Tara James Penny, who's a lecturer at San Jose State University, living in her car?
Yes, that was my colleague, Janie Haar, down in the Bay Area, and did that bit of reporting. And yes, she found this woman who is a lecturer and cannot afford housing. She sleeps in her car, I believe, several nights a week, and the rest of the nights of a week she sleeps at a friend's house. So this is the situation in these cities up and down the West Coast, where housing prices and rental prices have gotten so high that even the working poor cannot afford housing.
Well, I talked a few years ago now about a niece who was in the Berkeley area. She was working out there, and she managed to find a room in a house with a shared bathroom and kitchen for $1,800, just the room. And you met up with Jose Caro. He told you, until about 3 years ago, he was able to afford a small house in the suburbs in Seattle, money he made from gardening jobs. But then his landlord kept raising the rent. Let's listen.
That's one of the reasons why we are where we are, because we started renting at $750, a little room. It was a little house. And then he raised it to $1,200, and he wanted to go to $1,500. There's no way.
And so where is he now?
Well, actually, he is parked right next door to Stanley Timmings and his girlfriend that we just spoke about earlier. It's almost like a little community of homeless people living in RVs.
Yeah. Look, many of these are, as we said, the working poor just can't find housing. You also have the people with disabilities we spoke of, and addicts, and some of the people we think of as traditionally, you know, part of the homeless population. But what kind of issues are raised because it's become so large?
Well, you know, this has become a real flashpoint in a lot of cities, and it's become the number one political issue for local politicians in a lot of these places, because you have people who are really fed up with this, and they say, look, we sympathize with the homeless, but we don't want to look over the fence into our backyard and see a bunch of tents and garbage and, you know, things strewn about. And then there are people who say, well, look, we've got to do more. So it's a real dividing line, and it's caused a lot of debate, especially in Seattle, where there was just a big election for city council and a new mayor. It was a huge part of the campaigning there.
Well, look, it's not as if they're not spending money. In all of these areas that you looked at, voters approved more than $8 billion in spending on affordable housing and homeless programs since 2015. Seattle alone spent $61 million on homeless-related issues. Seattle also is doing things like permanent supportive housing units for people who are severely addicted or mentally ill, but as soon as they build one, it fills up. What is some thinking about how this gets solved?
Well, I think the solution, the long-term solution, is to build more affordable housing, but that takes time, years in some cases, to get those built. And there are not enough shelter beds in the meantime. And I think that some cities are, like Seattle, are taking a pretty progressive look at this, and they're saying, well, look, what can we do to make things easier for homeless people in the short term? And some of those things are, you know, Seattle has a $15 an hour minimum wage. They have passed laws saying that landlords have to take the first applicant for an apartment. They can't discriminate based on a variety of factors that landlords often use to discriminate against homeless people. So there are policy changes that can be made that will help. But the bottom line is there needs to be more affordable housing constructed.
Well, meanwhile, the agencies that are involved with this community are, you know, out of their minds. They say it's like whack-a-mole. You know, the police try to move the encampments along or disband the RV groups, but they just pop up somewhere else. And you quote Jerry Lemoyne, who's a case manager with REACH, the Seattle Homeless Assistance Program. He says it's a refugee crisis right here in the United States, right under our noses. Is there any push to address this from other angles? You know, is there a push to somehow address maybe the companies that are bringing in these workers that are taking all the housing, maybe somehow have them kick in to provide housing? I mean, is anyone thinking outside the box?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting you should ask that. I think I already mentioned that Seattle passed a $15 an hour minimum wage, partly to address this situation. And there are also proposals in Seattle right now to start a head tax on businesses. So, for example, if you are an employer and you have a certain number of employees in the city, that you would be taxed per employee, and then that tax would go directly into homelessness funding.
Yeah.
And that's a proposal out there. And, you know, things like that are very controversial, and you'll find people on both sides of the issue. You know, there are, as we say, NIMBYs, which I think everyone's familiar with, and then there are YIMBYs, which is yes in my backyard. And there are people who are saying, why do we feel that everybody needs to be sheltered with a roof over their head in the traditional sense? What if we really expand this concept of tiny houses? What if we, you know, there's one organization in Seattle that's building these tiny houses, and they're asking residents to open their backyards and have a tiny house put in their backyard and host a homeless person or a homeless family in their backyard. Portland is looking at the same thing. You know, there are a lot of different discussions going on, a lot of different directions. You know, this issue goes much deeper than the conversation we're having here. It's really a societal question. It's really a fundamental crack in our society that this kind of thing can develop.
Well, you and your colleagues met workers who are, you know, going in alongside other workers, but unbeknownst to them, the other workers, that worker may have bought a gym membership just so they can have a place to shower because they're sleeping in their car. We mentioned the lecturer, the San Jose State University lecturer. She's, you know, grading papers in her Volvo at night. Her husband's too big for the Volvo, so he sleeps in a cot outside. And there's a great anecdote about a class she was teaching on John Steinbeck and the Grapes of Wrath. One of the students said she was sick of hearing about the homeless, and of course John Steinbeck wrote about the migrants. What did she say?
As she said, you know, something to the effect of, you know, you're looking at one.
Yeah.
Which, you know, meant she was homeless, and her student, it was, you know, you could have heard a pin drop. Her students were completely silent.
That's Gillian Flaccus with the Associated Press in Portland, Oregon, and part of the AP's team that looked at the crisis of homelessness on the West Coast. We'll link you at herenow.org. Gillian, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And the AP also reports New York has a right to shelter court mandate that requires the city to provide shelter beds for everyone on the street, so the visible homelessness is much less. But would working people go there? Are you wrestling with the lack of housing on the West Coast? We'd love to hear from you at hereandnow.org.
And now to a country we don't often hear from, Uzbekistan. It's home to more than 30 million people and is sandwiched in Central Asia between Russia, China, and Iran. A security conference just wrapped up there, and for the first time in 12 years, a BBC reporter was allowed into the country. That would be the BBC's Will Vernon, who joins us from the capital, Tashkent. Will, why did they let the BBC back in?
Well, that's a very good question, Jeremy. So the BBC applied for permission to come to Uzbekistan and report on this sustainability and security conference, which is held under the auspices of the UN. And the Uzbek authorities granted us that permission. So as you say, it's the first time in 12 years that a BBC team has been allowed to report from inside the country. And under the new president, relatively new president, Shavkat Mirziyoyev, certain cautious liberalizing reforms have been passed. And the country appears to be slowly opening up to the outside world. And this UN conference is part of that. And the authorities here in Tashkent are obviously keen for international recognition and attention, you know, for the world to see that changes are happening here.
Well, and you talk about the newly elected president there was elected last year after the death of Islam Karimov, who was described as a ruthless authoritarian. What is this thaw that you're talking about? What kind of reforms are going on in Uzbekistan?
Well, on the face of it, there definitely seems to be some changes happening here. The new president has undertaken currency reforms. He's released a relatively small number of political prisoners. And he's opened a new government portal, basically through which ordinary citizens can file complaints against officials. And that specifically, that system is something which diplomats here tell us is becoming an effective tool in fighting corruption and inefficiency and other problems. But on the other hand, if you talk to liberal journalists and human rights activists, they react quite cynically, actually, to questions about whether these reforms are genuine. And there is criticism that their only aim is to present a veneer of democracy in exchange for certain economic benefits and sort of political cooperation with Western countries. And, for example, the very powerful and widely feared head of the security service remains in post. And the security service is still very, very powerful here. And there is still evidence, for example, that forced labor is used to pick cotton during the summer months. But officials here in Tashkent quietly tell us that the people are eager for more freedoms, but that it takes time. And I think the coming months and years will show whether any significant tangible results will come about. And just last month, a human rights defender and a journalist were arrested here. So Uzbekistan still has a very long way to go.
Well, and Uzbekistan was just in the news here in the United States recently because it was an Uzbek national who won a visa to come to the U.S. and then ended up mowing down pedestrians and cyclists in that terrorist attack in New York City. Was there any talk about that attack at the conference you were at?
There wasn't any specific mention of that at the conference, but the story is one of the most widely discussed subjects in Uzbekistan at the moment. As you say, Saifullah Saipov came from Tashkent and was radicalized, allegedly was radicalized in the U.S. It's worth noting that Uzbekistan has little or no problems with Islamic extremism inside the country, and the form of Islam practiced here is very moderate. The vast majority of Uzbeks utterly condone all forms of violence and radicalism. And, you know, the bars here in Tashkent are full of young men and women drinking alcohol, dressed in sort of Western styles. And the Uzbek nationals who have carried out terrorist attacks in the West, according to reports, have all been radicalized abroad. But religion is tightly controlled in Uzbekistan, and all imams must be registered with the authorities. But we've managed to speak to several people who knew Saifullah Saipov. All of them said he was a polite, friendly and educated man from a good family who never shared any interest in religion, let alone extremism. So the whole topic of extremism is a very sensitive one in Uzbekistan.
If you look at Uzbekistan on a map, you see that it's in the middle of a lot of countries. It's very close to Iran and it's very close to Russia. What does it feel like inside the country, that it's closer to being a former Soviet state or that it is closer to the Muslim world in the Middle East?
Well, Uzbekistan is a former Soviet state. People still speak Russian here, but recently, in terms of sort of political changes within the country, the president has tried to sort of tread that line between recognizing that this is a Muslim majority country and remembering that millions of Uzbeks live and work in Russia. A large part of the economy relies on money being sent back from Russia. And like many places in Central Asia, Uzbekistan very much feels like it's at that kind of crossroads between Asia, Russia, and even Europe.
That's the BBC's Will Vernon joining us from Tashkent in Uzbekistan. Will, thank you.
Thanks very much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.